about how many lenses or glass components total are within that system?
It's really a mistake to think that more lenses is necessarily better. You do lose a little light transmission with each lens. You can't perfectly anti-reflection coat them, so there's a little bit of light transmission loss. But added lenses does improve image quality. It gives the optical engineer an opportunity to put more correction, as they call it, in each element. So it's a careful trade-off and balance that they have to pay attention to.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. Our guest this week is Vicki Peters. She is a product manager for Leupold Optics, and she helps us understand rifle scopes, what all goes into them, how they're made, the precision that's involved, and then helping us understand what rifle scope is best for our needs, as well as some of the differences between, say, a $200 rifle scope and those that exceed over $1,000. So this is a great discussion if you want to learn more about rifle scopes, understand how they work, understand how to select one that's best for your needs, and make an informed purchasing decision. Before we dive into the show, I want to give a shout out to Bailey from Tennessee for leaving us the iTunes review. Bailey, contact us with your shipping information and we will send you some Exo Mountain Gear swag. Listeners, if you want to be entered into these giveaways, just leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you're listening to this. Or you can also contact us directly with your questions, comments, or feedback to podcast@exomountaingear.com. Okay, let's dive right into the show with Vicki Peters from Leupold Optics. Vicki, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Steve, how you doing on that end, buddy?
Yeah, really good. Excited to learn a little bit more about optics from Vicki here.
Yeah, absolutely. So Vicki, you're with Leupold. What is your title there? What's your position there?
I am Gold Ring Product Line Manager. So I manage development of all of the rifle scopes that have a gold ring on them. The exception, of course, being like tactical professional scopes are not mine.
Okay. So for those of us who might not be as familiar with the Leupold line, what is the Gold Ring line? What sets that apart from the others?
The Gold Ring line has obviously a gold objective trim ring when you see it in the stores, and that signifies that it comes from our Beaverton, Oregon factory, as do our professional scopes with black rings as well. But it also designates that it's targeted at the commercial market generally, although there's a lot of commonality with the professional products, a lot of co-development we do between the Gold Ring commercial products and the things that are designed for snipers, that kind of thing.
I can imagine being the product manager of even just that portion of the line. The Gold Ring line is quite extensive. Can you give us an example of kind of the breadth of rifle optics that are available within that line?
Yes. As of this year, we just launched the new VX Freedom, which is our entry-level portion of the line, replaced VX1s and 2s and several other scopes. So VX Freedom, we have VX3i, which is a great lightweight general purpose hunting scope. VXR, which is all illuminated models. VX5HD, which is a 5-to-1 zoom ratio system and just probably the heart of our product line. The best choice, I think, for general purpose shooting. And then the VX6HD is our premier line and it's just a fully loaded, has all the features line.
You mentioned these are the entire Gold Ring lines coming out of the factory there in Oregon, so all assembled here in the U.S.?
Yes. Actually, our policy is anything that is used for aiming a projectile that comes out of our factory.
I didn't realize that that was the case for across the line like that, aiming a projectile.
Right. We do also have, you know, gold ring spotting scopes and a few other gold ring products in other lines, but in the rifle scope line, we're adamant that all products have to come out of our factory, so we have control over that critical portion of the system.
Nice.
Yeah, we're going to talk here a bit later for sure about the factory, the process, kind of the components, what goes into that. But I'm just curious as well, because I know that there's such a heritage with the Leupold brand. But if you could just kind of give us the elevator speech on the history of the company, the brand, and then kind of, you know, the developments that led to where you guys are at with a state-of-the-art facility in Oregon today.
Sure. We're a fifth-generation family-owned business owned by the two families, Leupold and the Stevens family. We have family members that work right in the building that are there for board meetings and that are intimately involved in the business, which is really unique. It's great to not be a publicly held company, so we can have our priorities aligned with long-term benefits to our owners and our customers, or especially the consumers. The company was founded in 1907, and originally we developed our optical experience by repairing survey transits years ago. And in 1948, I hope this is right, Marcus Leupold was out hunting and he missed a shot because his scope fogged up, and he said he could build a better scope than that. So that was the birth of Leupold rifle scopes, was a personal experience with optics fogging up, and we pioneered the filling of a scope with dry gas to keep it from fogging.
I'm curious, you know, as you're managing this product line, you obviously have, you know, a deep awareness of the entire line and all these different purposes of scopes. Just to kind of give context for listeners who are maybe newer to selecting a rifle scope, where would you start? You know, let's a proverbial customer calls you, says that, you know, oh, I need a scope for my rifle and I'm hunting. I know that's a, you know, super broad question, but what are some of the questions you would ask back at them? Maybe about the weapon system, maybe about the species they're hunting, the terrain they're hunting. Like, what are some of the big things we should be thinking through as we make an informed purchasing decision for a rifle scope?
The first thing I usually ask is what sort of distances they think they're going to be shooting with this setup, and talk through how they, you know, what their experience is and how they think their shooting at these distances is going to be achieved. If they're a typical hunter who's not planning on dialing and trying to shoot an elk at 700 or 800 yards, like you hear a lot of people about doing, if they're doing more traditional ranges, you know, 500 yards or less, I'd say, then we don't worry so much about, you know, getting a whole lot of elevation travel and setting them up for dialing in for extremely long shots. We prepare them for, you know, at whatever distances they're planning on supporting. And that's where, if they're going beyond 300 yards, we talk through the CDS dial system we have, which is a custom ballistic dial system. That where we're able to laser your elevation dial with the exact ballistics for your bullet, so you just turn to the distance after you use the rangefinder to acquire the range, and it's really improved people's ability to take, you know, honestly, even a 275 or 300 yard shot, it's nice to be dialed perfectly where you hold right on for that shot. So that's one of the most important things.
Yeah. Sure.
Secondarily, I think is, are you shooting in low light? And I got to tell you, I'm looking out my window right now at a black-tailed doe. Oh, there's two of them, actually.
Oh, perfect.
and the sun is going down. It's just perfect test lighting right now for what it would be like to try to see something with our optics. I'd go to Washington every year and hunt white-tailed deer up there, which is kind of unusual for the Northwest, I'll be honest. This is kind of black-tail and elk country up here, mule deer as well, but having hunted a lot of whitetail over the years, real low light performance is a huge concern for hunting any animals that step out at the very last light like this. And I think that in order to get great performance in low light, It takes some really sophisticated, great engineering of the optics. So, you know, you have good contrast, good image quality, great lens coatings. So like our Twilight Max light management system we have in the VX3i is a great example of that. Gives really good performance. And then objective size. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, a 50 millimeter objective versus a 40 millimeter objective can give more like, you know, over 40% additional light energy into your eye, depending on your own eye pupil size. So if you are planning on shooting in, you know, again, animals that tend to come out at the very last light, and whitetails are a great example of that, it really is worth investing in that larger objective.
40%, that's a surprising number, yeah.
Well, I'll give you a little engineering geek talk. It's a function of the area of the lens as opposed okay. to the diameter. So when you think about pi r squared and you take those two formulas and compare it, it's that area of energy that you're producing that makes the difference.
Okay, yep. Makes sense.
Yeah. So what is, I mean, the downside to going with a larger objective is just the bulk and the weight of that?
Yeah, I think that's the primary thing. There's the bulk and the weight. You have to mount the scope a little higher. That can be an issue. If you like a fast pointing firearm, you know, I honestly use a lot of 3-9 compacts on my, like I've got a little short Swede Mauser I use for hunting mule deer that is great for just having to take a quick running shot, you know? So it's nice to have that lower profile for that. I think the other thing that's kind of more obscure is that the larger objective gives you a shallower depth of focus. So it can be harder to get a great focus on a target up close, for example. If you have a small objective, then things look good at every distance. So there's a little bit of a trade-off there, but it's not a huge consideration, just something to think about and compare.
Yeah, that's a good start for sure. With rifle scopes, it's one of these things where you pull up a sight, you see all the scopes, you might not fully understand all the differences. You see all these numbers and comparisons and, you know, things we've already mentioned with objectives, and you can get into exit pupils, and there's so many kind of specifications to that. And one thing we wanted to do on this episode is not necessarily go through every specification we see on paper, but really understand kind of the anatomy of a rifle scope, what goes into it, how do they function, what are the critical components, what role do those components play. So let's go ahead and start to break the anatomy down if we can, Vicky, and let's just go ahead and talk about one of the main things, and that is the glass. So obviously there's, glass front and rear. You have the exit objective. You have the eyepiece. There's glass there. Tell us a bit about those specific lenses and then the other glass components within the system and kind of the roles that they play to help us understand how our rifle scope is functioning.
Okay, so I'll go hopefully not too deep into basics, but let's talk about, you know, there's two basic categories of glass that go into every optical system. There's crowns and flints, as they call them. If you remember that picture of Pink Floyd's prism, you know, with the light separating coming out of a prism, one crowns separate light in one direction and flints in the opposite direction. So they're used together to cancel things out. And color correction is a huge part of getting great contrast in particular, but good resolution and just a sharp image. So you end up with many cemented together pairs of glass throughout the system. They call that a doublet. So the most simple optical system, simple rifle scope, has at least a doublet up front on the objective. Now, the objective is the most important lens in the system in that it has so much power that it produces, you can't improve anything that's been destroyed by the objective later in the system. So you have to start with good works up front. And this objective is sometimes as many as 4 or 5 elements, especially in a higher powered scope. So there's a lot going on there.
And when there's 4 or 5 like that, are they sandwiched together or is there space between them? How does that work?
There's generally no more than 2 elements ever cemented together, and then they'll be separate. And so you'll have a cemented doublet and then a singlet, as we call it, a single piece of glass without a partner, and then another doublet or something like that. The other consideration there is as you move it through that objective system, it has, so those later elements, it's everything in front of the front focal plane is considered the objective. The last couple elements there in front of that front focal plane are used for focusing and anything with a side focus system. So it's important to, you know, design it where you get the travel and that focus. It's another thing you have to think about. And that while you focus, your image quality is great and all these different combinations of positions of the lens. So behind that is your front focal plane. And let's talk about what a front focal system is for a second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a front focal reticle, its subtensions, you know, it grows and shrinks along with the target image. And so the subtensions on the target are always the same. So if you're using holdovers or milliradian markings or something like that, you can count on them on whatever power you're on. The downside is that when you're on low power, the reticle is really small. And when you're on high power, the reticle is really big and covering up a lot of target, which is not always optimal, you know?
So as you increase the zoom and the object you're seeing through the scope increases in size, the actual reticle is increasing relative with that.
Yep.
And exactly. That's on a first focal plane.
Yep.
Okay.
So now you move back to the next couple. There's generally two groups of lenses, sometimes more, but most often there's a zoom cluster of lenses and a focus correcting cluster of lenses in the erector system. So when you get into the erector system, it's, you know, they are considered relay lenses as well. So what they do is they pick up the image at the front focal plane and reassemble it at the rear focal plane. So having that focus stay correct all the time is a big design challenge. There's little adjustments done at the factory, that kind of thing, in order to make sure that that focus doesn't shift and that the point of aim doesn't shift as you move these lenses around.
Mm-hmm.
But now you get your great zoom range. You know, nowadays we're getting up to, you know, 8 to 1 zoom in our product line at the top end. And have really great optical performance. I've noticed that some, you know, I've seen some scopes out there that might have a lot of zoom range, but they don't perform well in the middle of the zoom range. So that's one of the big challenges, is to make it where image quality is good on every power setting that someone might use.
With a scope with a higher zoom range, are there more lenses in that zoom cluster? Like, what makes that scope capable of having this higher zoom range?
It's funny because the erector cells generally don't have more lenses.
Okay.
There's more lenses in other places, though, that keep the field of view large and that kind of thing. So it does take some additional lenses. They're not in the moving cells at all.
Oh, okay.
So as you move back, you know, now we're getting back towards the, you know, and some of our systems have a lens right near the last, the second focal plane. And that is something that corrects field, fills up the whole field view with well-transmitted light. It makes sure that it doesn't block any light out, so it doesn't get sort of gray. It has a nice bright look at the edge. It's very sharp. And now when you get to the rear focal plane, if this is where your reticle is, let's talk about that for a minute. So the rear focal plane is where you put a reticle where, as you zoom the image in and out, the reticle doesn't change appearance at all. And what's nice about that is, you know, on high power, your reticle is covering less of the target. So if you're trying to make fine shots, that's very handy. The bad side is that your subtensions are changing. So if you had aiming points, for example, they are only accurate typically on high power. But what we do in some of our scopes that I think is a really cool feature is we put like an MOA or a mil-based reticle in there. And then on a VX6 HD or a 5 HD, you'll see that there's a mark on the power selector that you can turn the power selector to that mark. And now you just double all the subtension numbers. So where it was 1 mil or 1 MOA, now it's 2 mil or 2 MOA. So it's perfectly functional at two different settings. So you can turn it down when there's a lot of heat mirage, for example, and you don't want to see those waves out there and you're wanting to aim at a target without high power, you still have a functional position for the power selector.
That's awesome. Is there a specific name that you guys have for that feature? Did I miss that?
Hmm. We don't have a specific name for that feature. That would be handy.
Well, the reason I ask is I'm just curious for listeners or even myself to go back later. And if I'm, you know, looking at the loophole, you know, lineup, which scopes have that? Is there a way to distinguish that? Did you say it was across the VX5 and 6 line?
It's in the VX5 and 6 line. And in some cases, there's not an actual witness line there because there's a magnification number right there. But much everything in the 5 and 6 HD line have that ability.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. That's neat.
Yeah.
That's really cool, yeah.
So the last element in the system is the eyepiece, and it obviously magnifies the image and relays it out to where your eye is placed, which is called the exit pupil, which is at the distance called eye relief. That's all generated by the whole system where you get it in the right place, where you don't get hit in the face with the scope when you shoot a heavy recoiling firearm. So that's a really critical part of the whole design, is getting this great eye relief. But the eyepiece obviously also has the important function of being able to focus the reticle. So you focus that reticle image and get it nice and sharp. And then you had that side focus earlier too, that you would focus the target with. And by the time you're done, you've got a system that's all perfectly set up for your shooting situation.
So if we take, one of the VX6, either 2-12 or 3-18, whatever, about how many lenses or glass components total are within that system?
A few years ago, people used to call and ask how many lenses were in a system. But it's really a mistake to think that more lenses is necessarily better. You do lose a little light transmission with each lens. You can't perfectly anti-reflection coat them, so there's a little bit of light transmission loss. But added lenses does improve image quality. It gives the optical engineer an opportunity to put more correction, as they call it, in each element. So it's a careful trade-off and balance that they have to pay attention to about getting the right number of lenses to balance light transmission and image quality performance.
The reason I asked was to understand exactly that point. Does more lenses, you know, just, it's another chance to degrade the image, or is it another chance to improve the image? And it sounds like it's a balance of both.
Yeah, generally more lenses will make, it gives the engineer a chance to make the image quality better.
There's a lot of talk about coatings, and that's something that we've already mentioned. When I previously thought of coatings, I was thinking of just the exposed glass, you know, the objective and the eyepiece having some coating, but are different lenses throughout the system have different coatings for that engineer to then work with the image quality?
Yep. And actually it used to be we used single layer of magnesium fluoride on some elements. That's what the old original coatings were. Before there were coatings, a whole rifle scope would have like 50% light transmission. When we got magnesium fluoride, it brought it up to like, you know, 82-85, something like that range. Nowadays, we're not only getting great light transmission, you know, in the middle of the spectrum, but all the way from the reds, you know, across the entire visible spectrum, we try to bring up the transmission up into the 90s or close to it. So each layer, each surface has multiple layers, like somewhere between at least, you know, like 4 to 6 layers of coating, and sometimes as many as a dozen or so. Yeah, a lot goes into that. Coating design is an art in and of itself.
Right. I know we talked about the focus as well as the magnification elements and how those are part of the system, but I'm just curious, and this is probably a gross oversimplification simply because I'm ignorant, but are those lenses just mechanically moving back and forth, if you will, to maintain and achieve focus and or magnification? Like, as you turn the focus ring or turn the magnification dial, is it literally just physically moving internal lens components?
Yep. And so what's really important, I mean, if a perfect optical system, you would keep them all lined up, like you had a rod right down the center of all the lenses, would be awesome. You know, you'd get the most optical performance possible out of that. So yes, as you zoom, that happens, as you change focus. The one exception to that is making adjustments, and you have no choice but to tilt something in order to look somewhere else. And in rifle scopes, we typically tilt the erector system, so that little cluster of erector lenses tilts not a huge amount. It's like, you know, less than a degree total of swing gives you enough to get the entire adjustment travel that you need.
So is tilting, is that how the reticle is adjusted for sighting in? And that is that what turrets are doing? Are they tilting a lens?
They're tilting that cluster. So there's what's called a pivot tube. And the pivot tube has a, you know, like a ball seat thing that is right around the rear focal plane typically. And so that's where your reticle is in a lot of scopes. And there's a spring system that's very carefully engineered to keep contact with the adjustment screws at all time. And make sure it instantly reacts when you turn a screw. And so when you turn the screw, it's pivoting it along, you know, around that rear focal plane.
Wow. Man, it's wild to think about everything that goes into this, and the precision of it, especially when you get into making these adjustments, you know, that a click can precisely adjust something, that amount, and another click does, if it's a good scope, adjust it that equal amount again. You know, thinking of doing processes like box sighting in a rifle and making sure that your adjustments are moving things the same amount forward, up and down and left and right. I mean, the precision involved is just, it's insane for me to think about.
It is really amazing. And I'll tell you that, and there was this period of time a decade or so ago that I supervised a production line of a product that worked on developing the CQT rifle scope. And I made an attempt to build an erector system and rifle scopes myself. And I was so glad I didn't have to make a living as an assembler. the skill level of our assemblers is just amazing. And the machinists, I mean, out there, and they had me run some parts, and I made a whole bad batch of main tubes we had to throw out. So,
So another aspect in terms of internals, beyond the glass and the coatings, which we mentioned, is something that you mentioned up front in terms of going back to this whole issue that Leupold was trying to solve with fogging and things like that. And that's this nitrogen or other gas systems. What, tell us about that, kind of the internal gas component, within the rifle scope.
Sure. So I, you know, there's a lot of secret sauce there I can't share, but I can
nobody's
tell you
listening.
That's...
It's just us.
but there's getting that, you know, I do know that, you know, when I've toured Asian facilities, because, you know, we do have range finders and other things like that. So we're familiar with some of those manufacturers that, you know, when they fill something with nitrogen, they just like put it in a chamber, you know, and then put the ends in. And in our case, it's a much more sophisticated process than that purges the ambient gas from the inside of the scope and ensures that it's filled with dry gases. And we've kind of recently quit talking about exactly what the formula is, because we've been making advances in those gases, and we don't want to share the recipe. It's one of those, it's like the Coca-Cola recipe that we're just trying to keep ourselves.
It's under lock and key. Only members of the actual Leupold family even know.
That's right. The safe,
you know? That's wild. So how does parallax play into this? Is that another lens adjustment?
If parallax is that side focus adjustment, or in some cases the adjustable objective, where you move the front part of the objective. And what you're doing when you adjust side focus or adjustable objective is you're refocusing the image right on the reticle plane for your target distance. So, so if you have a target at, you know, 400 yards, you're going to turn that side focus and you're going to bob your head up and down while you're on a nice rest, and you're going to look for movement, and turn it until there's no more target movement. So parallax is when you get your eye way off center. If you got all the way off the center where things are starting to go black, it was where you'd have the maximum movement from that. It's because it's like, you know, two fence posts on the side of the road. You look at it, you move back and forth, and you can see them moving in relationship to each other because they're at a different depth. So you're trying to get them at the same depth is what you're doing. You know, if you put your eye in the center and if you have a good cheek weld all the time, parallax adjustment is far less critical. I do hear some people, especially some of the top tier special forces people, also use side focus to focus back through the air between them and the target and judge the wind by how the mirage behaves in those areas. So that's another really interesting application for it. Honestly, when I'm carrying a rifle and hunting, I set it on 200 yards and leave it there, because you have to get on a solid rest to be able to really check and make sure it's good. You have numbers on the dial, but temperature changes and environmental conditions can affect the accuracy of those marks so much. Your scope grows and shrinks because it's made of aluminum enough to make some focus differences you have to be concerned about there. So it's best to carry it on 200 yards.
So what else about either components or the manufacturing process, or really what goes into the build quality of a rifle scope, can you help us understand so that as we're looking at, you know, scopes that range from, goodness, $200 to $2,000, and separating those apart from a quality perspective? Because obviously there's bells and features, some of which we can talk about here in a bit, in terms of illuminated reticles and those types of things that increase cost. But just from a quality perspective, is whether it's components, again, or the build process, or something you can share with us about the manufacturing that goes into these scopes, just to help us understand really what's all involved.
So I think zoom range is worth talking about, because when you go up in zoom range, the lenses have to get a little bigger. If you kind of picture they're sliding in and out on a cone, and you don't want to be clipping any of that cone off, they have to get bigger where they can encompass the larger part of it. So the larger lenses are a little more expensive. Tolerances have to get tighter on larger zoom ranges to make sure you have no point of aim shifts throughout all the adjustments that you're making here. So zoom range is a great benefit. It's great to have this huge field of view at low power and then lots of power at the high power that make you super versatile for shooting fast moving targets and all the way out to precision long range shots. But, I would be cautious about buying a high zoom scope that's inexpensive, because it's not liable to have all of that careful engineering put into it. I think the other, things that are challenging are, you know, building really great, you know, sealing systems to make that fog-proof system last forever. I've seen scopes over the years that, from, you know, even some great European competitors that were kind of designed to work with the adjustment covers on, for example, because the adjustments would leak if you put them in our water tank. So we take very seriously, we 100% test all of our rifle scopes to make sure that their seals are all completely functional before they leave the factory. I think, you know, every scope is put on multiple collimators, which is a simulator of, it's an optical system that simulates long distance viewing. And so, carefully judging that the scope performs like it's supposed to, the adjustments respond exactly how they're supposed to, track properly. Those are tremendous challenges to do consistently. And, I think it's, you know, we've got a great process there. And again, those awesome assemblers that do such a good job of paying attention to those details every day. So it is difficult to get people that are meticulous and can handle, doing this kind of work every day. It's very, it can be tedious. And so, it's important to rotate people around into positions where they don't get fatigued from trying to do these things. So the human factor, so much of this is put together by human beings. There's not a lot of automation in putting these things together. So really paying attention to the people and taking care of them and giving them the right tools to do a good job every day is really critical to this whole process.
It sounds like the vast majority of assembly and work that goes into building these scopes in your factories is done by human hands.
It is. I would say that for the most part, automation is sort of limited to ergonomic issues for us, you know, saving people from repetitive stress, injuries, and that kind of thing. And for the most part, it's very difficult to simulate the human touch on how an adjustment feels. And how a power selector turns and those kinds of things. So we really need our people. They do a great job. So,
I would love just to cover a little bit as well on helping listeners, if they pick up a scope Maybe they're looking at a buddy's rifle setup. Maybe they walk into one of the big box retailers that has scopes that they can peer through. What are some things that they can do when they get hands-on and are evaluating a scope besides just kind of, you know, look back and forth and feel and, yeah, that one looks clear, that one looks good, or right, that one's better on the edges. You know, those things are sort of intuitive, but are there any other sort of processes or tests? I've heard of guys turning the scope and looking down the objective end to maybe see some imperfections because you can see things differently. Is there any validity to that or anything else that you can kind of give our listeners to evaluate a scope when they get hands-on?
So I will say that I hear about people looking through the objective, but there's not really a meaningful performance parameter you're going to find by doing that. You know, it's possible you'll find, you know, dings on parts or some dirt or something like that. But honestly, optics are relatively impervious to dirt. You could have it half covered with dust and you'd still have a great image. You know, you'd lose 50% light transmission if it was half covered with dirt, obviously. But it's a kind of a wrong thing to focus on, I think. The first thing I look at when I pick up a scope in a store to see what the quality is I pick it up and I try to aim it at something bright white, like a bright white piece of paper or something like that. I'm looking for how big is the field of view inside the eyepiece. So if it looks like you're looking through a toilet paper tube and the field of view looks really small, that's a sign that the optical designer took a shortcut to getting the edges of the image are the most challenging to make good in optical design. And the easiest thing to do, rather than fixing them with more glass and better glass, is to just cut them off. And so they'll put an aperture in there that just cuts the field of view down. So that's number one. I also notice with that bright white paper that if the color correction is not great, you'll sometimes see a bright yellow glow around that edge, and that's kind of a sign that your contrast probably is not going to be great through that scope. And then thirdly, I think looking for glare. I think glare is really an important performance character in scopes. It's a bit of a challenge to do this in the store. I know I can do it, but I'm not sure how well it translates for everybody. Let me take a run at this. If you put a scope on high power and you kind of aim it generally towards a light, maybe not right at a light, so you're being blinded while you're looking at it, you're looking at how much of the inside of the scope is reflective and brightly white lit. And what you'll find is in the middle, all scopes are going to be pretty well lit because the erector system, you move those lenses, it's a greased surface, and that part is reflective. But it's also so far inside this tube, not a lot of light's going to get there and bounce off of it. So really you want to look way up towards the front, the objective end, and do you see any big reflective areas up there? If there are, it probably means that if you're out there in low light, your image is going to wash out by the light reflecting and washing out. You're going to call that glare, veiling glare. So I think that's a good test. I would refrain from trying to look at targets inside a store at close distances because those aren't realistic distances for your scope. And the scope is focused at, you know, if it's a fixed objective, it's focused at like 150 yards. And so if you're trying to look at something at 5 yards, it's basically out of focus. It might not look blurry, but it's not going to be at its best. And it's not a realistic distance to actually use the product. The ideal thing is especially if you're at a mom and pop gun store, and they'll let you take the scope outside and compare it by looking at distant targets, really focus on looking at the edge of the image. Because that is the hard part to make good and make sure that it's good all the way across the field. So if you're trying to shoot target, you know, moving targets, or if targets wander into your field of view, you're not disadvantaged by inferior optics with that.
Man, that's good. That's helpful tips. I certainly picked up a lot there.
Yeah, that was great.
Like normally just looking back and forth. I'm like, yeah, that one looks better. That's awesome. Thank you. So let's kind of wrap up with the last segment here because, man, we're covering time already. It's going quick. I'd love to talk about some of the more modern features, bells and whistles, cool stuff, if you will. So one of those, which isn't, you know, a super modern feature, but something that within at least the current age is really important, and that's the CDS that you already mentioned, kind of the custom dial system. for the turrets. What all goes into a customer providing what they need to get an accurate CDS from Leupold?
So typically we ask people to, you can call 1-800-Leupold.com or you can look on our website to get started on this, but the pieces of information that we will need are, you know, what is the bullet? You know, manufacturer, you can generally get the ballistic coefficient from the manufacturer's information. We need to know your muzzle velocity out of your firearm, because that varies quite a bit, obviously, especially with barrel length, but even, you know, rifling type and that kind of thing can affect that. The environmental conditions are very important. So especially where you plan to use it. So, if you're going to be going on a hunt and, hunt in Colorado at 5,000 feet or something like that, that's going to make a significant difference on your ballistic. So they need to know those environmentals. And it's a great idea, if you are doing something like that, to not only provide where you're going hunting, but also your home conditions. So you can sight in with one dial and in your home conditions, and then put on this other dial when you go hunting that will compensate for those environmentals without changing anything else.
Yeah, I was going to ask exactly that, how difficult it was to switch and have different configurations for your one scope.
It does take an Allen wrench, you know, a hex key basically to remove one dial and put the other one on, but it's pretty straightforward, pretty quick. So yeah, you just undo a couple little screws and pull one off and set the other one on and tighten a couple screws and you're good to go.
Yeah. So essentially removing the cap and swapping those, and then obviously it would be helpful to verify that, but there's not much else involved in the process then?
That's correct. And definitely it's a good idea to verify it. I've learned a lot. I was talking with Ken Ayler from Ayler, Ayler Chronographs at the SHOT Show this year, and he was explaining how ballistic coefficients of the same bullets vary so much out of different rifles just because of their rifling type, for example. So until we know we can only know what the manufacturer says the ballistic coefficient is, but it is really going to vary based on your rifle a little bit. And at longer distances, especially if you're trying to shoot 1,000+ yards, you have got to know the exact performance of your firearm if you're going to be successful with that.
So let's talk a little bit about electronics that have worked their way into a rifle scope. Specifically, let's just start, you know, with the illuminated reticles. What are you finding is the most demand and helpful use for hunters with the illuminated lines?
So that's a good question. I think, we have two different, really distinctly different illumination systems. One is the fire dot system, which uses a fiber optic and has just one aiming point in the center. What's nice about it is it's as bright as a red dot sight for broad daylight use. So great for fast moving targets and that kind of thing. But you can also turn it down to give you good contrast as the sun's going down on, you know, in low light conditions. We also have glass reticles, just called illuminated reticles. They're not quite as bright, so they're not really designed for that sort of red dot-like performance, but they tend to have really nice intricate patterns, multiple aiming dots, things like that. Like the Varmint Hunter reticle has a whole bunch of windage corrections and things like that on it. So those features of illuminated reticles are all really useful. We also have fairly sophisticated electronics in there, so it has a motion sensor. It turns off the illumination if you leave it sitting for a while. And in the VX6HD, we even have an electronic reticle level. So if you're doing really long distance shooting, you know, if you have the system canted, your rifle's canted a little bit, it induces a windage error. And so this the electronic level, eliminates that issue.
Awesome. How does it, signify that within your field of view? What is it, how's it throwing that air?
So right now that product works by just if the reticle flashes. So if you're more than a degree off straight, then it starts to blink.
Wow. And does it show you which way you're canted?
It doesn't, but for the most part, we just instruct people, you know, if it's flashing, then just rotate a little more obviously in one direction, then bring it back until it stops.
Huh. Yeah, I had literally just, I wasn't aware of that feature at all until I was doing research for this show and saw that, and I was really curious how it worked.
It's been a great feature. It's really good for mounting scopes, too.
Uh-huh. I could totally see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the fire dot that was only fiber optic, or it's supplemented with an electronic reticle in low light situations?
It is only fiber optic, but if you turn it down, it can be very low light as well. It's still just one illuminated dot, typically. We've had multi-fire dot before, but typically it's one illuminated dot. But you can turn it way down, so it's great for low light performance.
What else would you have us know or go look at for considerations on choosing a rifle scope that we haven't covered?
Well, let me talk about locking adjustments, because I mean, this is the age of dialing our distances. We're all doing that a lot, and we have several really good locking adjustment systems that allow you to have no covers on the adjustments, but they're not going to accidentally move. So like VX6HD and most of the VX5HDs have the CDSZL2 adjustments, which have a lock at zero and then have two full turns of up elevation from there. So nearly 40 MOA of up elevation after sight in. So it's a great system, supports a lot of long range hunting applications, especially.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about how that lock is engaged and disengaged for adjustment then?
Sure. There's a large button that you depress and that disengages the lock. And then when you turn it off zero, now you can let go and just turn it and adjust until where you want to be. And when you're done and you want to return to zero, all you do is dial it down until you feel it click and you know you're back at zero.
Hmm. So it's another like spring-loaded little button then.
Yep. Yep, exactly.
So this is hotly debated and contested, but what about reticle choices? Just some, again, some kind of guidelines, some things to consider for listeners who may be interested in understanding what do I even need with the sometimes overwhelming choice of reticle options out there?
It's a good question. I think, you know, there's the basic old duplex reticle that's still in a lot of our scopes. You know, it's like a crosshair with a slightly thicker posts to the outside that help you quickly aim something. For many people, that really is just a great choice because there's just not too much going on. I think if you're not shooting beyond 300 yards, you just don't typically need a whole lot more. And many wet-tail hunters, I'm going to say, fit that category, you know. But if you are shooting some distances, it's nice to have some extra features on the reticle. Something like our TMRA reticle, which has pick marks spaced at 1 MOA, or the TMR that has milliradian-based spacings, give you some additional reference points that can extend your aiming possibilities. So let's say you don't have quite enough travel in your scope and you're trying to shoot a coyote a mile. What the heck? you can dial as far as you can get with whatever scope you have, and then you can calculate how many of those tick marks you need to add on there in order to make an even longer shot than you typically could. They also kind of give you that visual reference when you shoot bullet hits. If it hit low, for example, you could count how many ticks down it was, use that tick down as your aiming point, move up and use it to shoot with. So there's a lot of functionality in both the systems. And whether you go mil or MOA, I think as long as the adjustment and the reticle are in the same increments, you'll have the same capability for what we're talking about there.
Vicky, this has been so good. Just want to wrap up by obviously encouraging listeners to visit loophole.com if they want to check out the line of rifle scopes that you guys have to offer. Are there any other resources, whether from Loophole directly or just to help listeners understand rifle scopes further, that you would point them to?
I can't really think of anybody on the outside of the company that much, but certainly 1-800-loophole.com, our technical services guys are always there, to help answer questions. I think that's probably it.
All right, perfect. Well, Vicky, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks for your time. It was great.
Well, thank you, as always, for tuning in. Don't forget that you can go to exomountaingear.com/podcast to see all previous episodes and subscribe to make sure that you receive all episodes to come. If you have comments, questions, suggestions, anything like that, go ahead and reach out. We'd love to hear from you. Just email us to podcast@exomountaingear.com.